take it away.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. Well, welcome everyone to the Ask Six Figure Start Vault Insider Career Advice Teleseminar. We are very excited to kick off this this program for today, March 26, 2010. The call is muted, so we will have we want to make sure that we have a clean recording, because many people who can't attend this live will be downloading it and listening to it, but we have hundreds and hundreds that have already tuned in, which is terrific. You can get the replay of this entire call at the same call-in link, so please feel free to do so. There will be a lot of information, and I'm sure it's hard for you to write notes to as to our answers, but you can just simply listen to it again. With Instant Teleseminar, there is a Q&A button on the menu bar. Please use that to post questions or comments during the call. We would love to get that. And we are going to get started with previously submitted questions and go from there. In short, I'll just give you my background. For 25 years, I've been in Fortune 500 companies in the role of staffing, heading up staffing groups at companies like Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and Warner Lambert. Caroline?
Great. Yeah, and my name is Caroline Sunisa Levine, and I most recently headed university relations as well as a couple of other recruiting areas for Time Inc., the magazine publishing company. Before that, I was in retained search and worked with financial services, management consulting, technology, and new technology companies, including Accenture, Booz Allen, Oliver Wyman, Disney, ABC, TV Guide. So we've covered a lot of industries, and we're very excited to answer your questions. So should I jump in then,
Yeah,
Connie?
Go right ahead.
Okay, great. So the first question that I picked is, what is the darkest secret of interviewing that recruiters don't want candidates to know? And how should candidates work to improve their chances at establishing a good first impression? So there are a couple of sub-questions to this, and I'm hoping to cover as many as I can. The first thing that I found interesting about this question, this dark secret of interviewing. So we get that a lot from people who are asking almost for this magic bullet. What to say that will get you the job or what not to say to get the job. It is not any one thing. So if someone is telling you that there's a magic bullet for interviewing or for resumes or for any other aspect of the job search, they are definitely oversimplifying. The other point that I wanted to make is that this person asked that recruiters don't want candidates to know, as if we're somehow hiding things from candidates. And something, an adjustment that I would love for job seekers to make is to realize that there is no hostility between recruiters and candidates. So there is nothing that I would want more when I'm sitting in the recruiting chair than for the candidate that I'm speaking to be the candidate that we hire, because that means that the search is over and we can get back to work. So we definitely want the candidate that we're interviewing to be successful. So that being said, what are some of the things that I wish candidates knew when they were in the interview chair with me? You know, there are two things that you're going to have to prove when you get in that chair. You are 80% responsible really for the outcome of this interview. And I say 80% because there are always going to be things that happen in your job search that are out of your control, such as the budget disappears, the job changes, someone internally wants to move in that role. That stuff is out of your control. But in terms of what's in your control during the interview, you absolutely control showing that you have the ability to do the job and that you have the motivation to do the job. So you have to answer the question, can you do the job and do you want the job? And you have to prepare what those key messaging points you are going to have when you go into that interview. And if you can do that, you will have a good interview. And the second point about the first impression I think is very, very important, because oftentimes, and it really broke my heart, I would have very talented candidates where the interview would start basically 15 minutes into the interview, because then they would stop rambling, they would have been warmed up, they finally get into the flow of the interview. And frankly, again, by then it's too late. You know, we really formulate an opinion, a very strong opinion about someone within the first few minutes. And so everything you're doing after that is either confirming what we already believe or you're trying to dig yourself out of a hole. And so to the extent that you can start the interview when you're in the lobby and in the small talk, all of that stuff is very, very important, and you want to make sure you're good to go when the interview starts. Connie?
Okay, terrific. My question is from Ricky, who says that his question focuses on final interviews. In such a competitive environment, I assume that all final round candidates are seen as high potential candidates. How do interviewers really differentiate between final round candidates since they've already proven themselves in earlier stages? And I thought this was a good question because the final round interview is a critical stage. You can break down the interview into so many different things: what happens before, what happens during, what happens after. But if you're a final round candidate, and I've coached so many people that have gotten to the final rounds and blew it, and they didn't understand what was happening. I had someone go to the 11 final round interviews with fantastic companies, and she just blew it. And until I did the mock interview, that's when I realized what she was doing wrong. So, and I can get specific about that, but let me get back to this question. When I led staffing for Merrill Lynch's asset management business, my goal was to have three qualified candidates to select from. So three completely qualified candidates who could do the job, and we should be happy with any single one of them. So then we made the decision as to who we should give the offer to. So that decision was made by the hiring manager, HR, if HR is an active HR partner, and sometimes they're not, but sometimes they are, and perhaps one or two people of the team, or perhaps the entire team would weigh in. So there were really four things that we looked at in the very final rounds. We wanted to look at this cadre of great candidates, which one had just the right amount of experience we needed, which candidate would grow in the role and not be bored. You know, we didn't want to hire someone who was going to be bored and move on. We wanted to hire someone who actually could grow in the role as well and become a more seasoned or a more senior manager down the road. Because, listen, a lot of effort, a lot of time goes into finding the right person. We don't want them walking out the door in 2 to 3 years. And then we also wanted to know which candidate had the right skills, the exact right skills, and which one was most savvy. So we could have phenomenal candidates, but there's certain candidates that know how to follow up without pestering. They know when to follow up. They know exactly how to continue the networking process, even through the interviewing process. And then the fourth thing we looked about was that corporate culture thing. You know, it's an intangible, but who is going to fit the corporate culture the best? Who is going to fit with us where we want to, and knowing that we need to take the corporation or the company to a new place? So in that final round, it's very much, you know, you have to keep your energy up. You have to be like a pit bull. Don't let go of this offer until it's in your back pocket. So keep with the networking. Keep with the selling of your opportunities, just the right amount. That's where the savviness comes in. And oftentimes we have candidates who we have clients that we coach who stay very close to us during this final stage because it's very important. And when you get three or four candidates that are perfect for the job, all the previous scores are thrown away. You know, it's almost like you're starting from scratch and they look at everyone with a fresh eye. So the process continues until you start on your first day. That's when you know you can feel secure about getting that job.
Great. So Lauren asks, what is a good way to maintain contact with a corporate recruiter after several rounds of interviews? Should I periodically follow up with her, or should I wait until I find a new opening with the firm that might be a good fit for me? So again, a couple of interesting points there that I wanted to point out. So maintaining contact with a corporate recruiter. You don't only want to maintain contact with the recruiter. You also want to maintain contact with everybody else who is in the decision-making process. So as you are in the interview stage, pay attention to who the people are who are interviewing you, what departments they work for. And this is very true, especially, you know, the more senior that you go, because typically the roles that you're going to be interviewing for will be touching a number of different areas within the firm. And you want to influence the entire decision-making team, not just the recruiter, not just your prospective boss, but everybody who has a say. And that means the stakeholders for your work and your boss's boss. So really, you're wanting to keep in touch with all of these people through the process. What you can do in your very, very first interview, and this is something that a firm isn't necessarily going to offer to you, you're going to have to ask, is to really get a sense for, you know, where are you in this process? you know, how many candidates are you looking at? You know, where do I fall? What's the best way to keep in touch? When might I hear about the decision? Who should I coordinate with to ask about the status of my search? You can't just assume that's all going to fall onto the recruiter's lap or that the recruiter's going to share that information with you. So you want to know, you want to get a sense for what the process is going to look like. And then finally, should you wait until there's a reason to contact or should you be contacting periodically? You should absolutely be contacting periodically. I had said in my answer to the first question that sometimes things happen that are out of your control. The job search changes a little bit. Someone internal raises their hand. It changes the picture. The budget changes. So things are happening in between the spaces where you have dropped off your resume, you have scheduled an interview, the callbacks are happening, etc. As recruiters, we call that white space. So this is the space in between those different areas of the search. And a lot of things are happening on our side that make it out of sight, out of mind for you. So you absolutely want to be checking in. And again, not just about have you made a decision yet, have you made a decision yet, but really engaging us, and I mean us, the prospective employer, the recruiter, the boss, the boss's boss, the stakeholders, engaging us on things that you're doing on the outside that are going to impact our business, that show that you are thinking about our business in a compelling, in an intelligent way, sending us an article, sending us a status update about what else you're working on, that, so that you're not just twiddling your thumbs and waiting for us to get back to you. And a final point to that about keeping in touch on a regular basis, especially for certain industries, I would definitely put media there. You know, we hire so much on an as-needed basis, a just-in-time basis, and it's really hard for us to predict when those needs are going to occur. And because of that, I routinely interviewed people for exploratory reasons because by the time I found out that I needed someone in ad sales or in photo or in online or, you know, whatever part of the business, it was too late for me to launch a search. I would go back to my existing candidate pile and I would try to get in touch with people that I thought had done well in the interview that, you know, I thought could be good candidates. And so what that means is that, you know, people would come to see me and there wouldn't be a job. It would just be the start of a relationship. And these candidates that were able to keep in touch with me, keep their contact information current, these were the ones that I would be able to reach out to and want to reach out to. So it is, it's absolutely very important that you keep in touch with not just the recruiter, but everybody else that influences the decision during the gaps in your search. Connie?
Great. Stacy asked this question. What is the most important trait, behavior, leadership quality that I could bring from 30 years of serving in the military to an interview or a resume? So in my answer, it's going to pertain to military, but it's also going to pertain to people that are not in the military. But as a, you know, in my 20-plus years of staffing, we received a lot of resumes from people with military backgrounds, and we always thought very positively about what they would bring to the table. Because to a recruiter, military experience can mean the following. Is the person action-oriented, goal-oriented, in other words, oriented towards success? Do they have a firm group of processes? Leadership is a huge part of the military. Teamwork is crucial there, a sense of integrity. All of this is what we expect when we look at military experience. So that is something certainly that you can touch upon. My advice, whether you're in the military or not, is to be very specific about each of your top traits. In fact, you should, and everyone on the phone or everyone going through a job search process, should invest some time in listing out what their top 10 traits are. And next to each of those top 10 strengths, put a succinct example of how you excelled at each trait. You can build a bridge to any new career that way. You can slam dunk your characteristics as being exactly what the company is looking for that way. It's a really good way of knowing yourself and being able to talk about every aspect of yourself in an interview or in a cover letter for as well. And further to that point, when I recruited, I managed staffing for Merrill Lynch's asset management business for several years. And in asset management, you have investments, you have sales, you have marketing professionals. And I met with the heads of all of those groups to talk about what the five top traits were for them. And it was amazing. They were the exact same five, which were analytical skills, communication skills, teamwork, integrity, creative problem solving. So let's face it, any company would be interested in those five characteristics. And if they're amongst your top five, list an example of how you excelled at each. Be specific, because that will get you the interview. People say, what do I do in a cover letter to make a difference? In a cover letter, you need to be specific about what value you brought to your employer, because that is going to show what value you can bring to your future employers. So be specific, give an example. Increased sales by 25% by doing this, 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 and this. Decreased errors by, 75% by instituting this new system. So I need you to be specific. I need you to paint a picture for me. Tell me a story. The cover letter is not a regurgitation of your resume. Instead, it makes the case for why you should be employed, and it must be a compelling case. Now, some people are going to look at cover letters, and some people are not. I, as a recruiter, never did. I didn't care for the cover letter. I dove right into the resume head first. Caroline probably looked at cover letters more than I did. But you don't know who you're getting. You don't know if it's going to be someone like me or someone like Caroline. So write a compelling cover letter. There's no skin off your nose for doing it, and you make sure that it's compelling and that it makes a point and that someone says, I cannot let this person go. I have to screen them. I have to meet them, et cetera.
Great.
Caroline?
Well, by the way, I didn't look at cover letters either, but I did have some clients who absolutely put a lot of weight on the cover letter, and in those cases, I would absolutely look. So Garrett says, is there any point to sending unsolicited resumes if you think your expertise is a match with and would be a benefit to a company, yet there is not an open position to apply to that is an explicit match at this time? So should you send things unsolicited? Yes, you absolutely should. Absolutely, 100%. So here's something that you've got to think about. If you look at your own job search, from the point of view of a job seeker, what you're seeing is, okay, there's a job that's posted, there's a need, I'm going to apply for it. Your search starts there. You've identified a need, you apply. From the recruiter's point of view or the prospective employer's point of view, the job posting is the third step in their process. We've identified a need, we've gotten budget for the need, and then we decide, okay, how are we going to kick off this search? And it may or may not mean a job posting. It may mean that we look internally, we canvas referrals, we look at who's already in our candidate database, and then maybe we post the job. So not all openings are posted, and by the time they're posted, a bunch of people already know about the job, right? The person who approved the budget and the person who identified the need and approved the job. So if you can get into that really nice space, those first two steps of the employer's job search process, either by networking in there or getting into that, again, existing candidate pool, those exploratory interviews that I used to do as a media recruiter, that's where you want to be. And how are you going to get there if the only thing that you're doing is applying to posted jobs? You're going to get there by sending unsolicited resumes. Now, how do you do that in a way that's compelling? It isn't about blanketing the space with a bunch of resumes. It's about really being targeted and thinking about, okay, I want to work at Merrill Lynch or a Time Inc. or a Citigroup or wherever. I want to work at these companies. Here's why. This is what my value proposition is. And these are the people that are going to be interested in what I have to say. It might be the recruiter for the specific functional area that I'm targeting. It might be, and more probably is, the person who runs that actual functional area or department that I'm trying to get into. So if I'm trying to be a communications manager, I'm going to try to find out who the head of corporate communications is for that targeted company that I want to work for, and that is where I'm going to send my resume. And yes, it will be unsolicited, but you are going to send it in such a way that you are the answer to their prayers, and therefore they are glad to receive it. Connie?
All right. Now the topic is going to be troubleshooting your job search. So Jeff wrote in, how do mature or vintage employees deal with the real or imagined age bias in companies and interviews where there is a significant age difference? How do you deflect suggestions that, quote, you're overqualified, or, quote, you'll be bored, or we just can't afford you, without telling them to talk to their labor council about these code words? Listen, there are three types of interviewers out there, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And my answer is going to include all of those. There is a lot of bias out there. And bias is there for many reasons. One, because human beings all have biases. Two, because people like to hire in their own image, and I can't tell you how many thousands and thousands of dollars I've spent at Citigroup or Merrill Lynch or Warner Lambert with interviewer training, because you always have those rogue interviewers out there. You know, once I had a very seasoned investment professional ask a candidate what his parents did for a living. You know, I almost passed out. But these things are going to happen. But, again, biases. And because the hiring process is subjective, and it's just subjective. You can meet three people that will all take three different inferences from your interview qualities and your interview skills. And in fact, many people are interviewed by a group of four, five, six people, and you can imagine the colorful debriefing sessions you have with people like that, but with such a large number. But remember, when there are things in your control during an interview, and there are things out of your control during an interview. You cannot control bias, for the most part, but you can control the things that you bring to the table. You must know, as a candidate, you have to know what your value proposition is. What value do you bring to your employer? You have to be crystal clear about it. Someone with 25 years of experience is going to bring a whole lot more to the table than someone with 10 years of experience, but they may not want the 25 years, or they may not need it. So find the opportunities that do. You can't put a square hole into a square peg into a round hole. So you have to find those opportunities where there is going to be a match. So, you know, an important thing is never to take things personally. You know, a professional interviewer should have you leave the interview feeling valued, having a very positive experience. That doesn't always happen, and some people say, oh, it's because I'm too old, or, oh, it's because, you know, I have purple hair. You know, there's a million things going on. But I'll say to you, you don't know what that person is going through that day. Maybe they're having a horrible day. Maybe they're having a horrible time in their life. You just don't know. They could be in a miserable time in their life. Maybe they're just a really bad interviewer. But never take it personally. No matter what they do, what's in your control is to leave in a positive light. I do some volunteer work at a local employment group in my neighborhood, and I once had a 67-year-old man who had a slight accent talk to me about how he was feeling, you know, totally discriminated against. He said, not only my age, because they must be saying, what's a 67-year-old looking for a job when there are so many other people looking for a job, but also his accent. So I told him that, you know, he wanted an answer to that. And I said, you know, look, there probably are people out there that discriminate. But if you think about it too much, it's going to affect your attitude. It's going to affect your performance. So you almost have to block that out and say, you know what, today no one's going to discriminate against my age. No one's going to discriminate against my accent. And I'm going to go in there and do the very best I can do. So it's knowing your value proposition, being able to state it very succinctly in a very, very crystal clear way, in a very positive way, and a confident way. Because if you leave every interview in a positive light, even if it's not the job for you, they're going to remember you and say, if something opens up, they're going to think about you. But if you're disgruntled and you think they're holding things against you, they're going to stay away from you as far as they can. So do your very best. I remember during the Olympics, people were, you know, the gold medal winners were saying, I wasn't thinking about the medal. I was thinking about doing the very best I can do. That's what you need to do in a job interview. And you know what also? It's a numbers game. You have to have a lot of targets out there. You have to have a lot of activity. Because if the two or three don't call you back and you've got seven still in the hopper, you're going to be excited about that. And it's your job to keep motivated during the job search process. It's not easy. Nothing that's worth anything ever is easy. But you have to keep motivated and you have to keep positive because you're in control of that. And if you lose control in that, it's going to spiral down, and you don't want to do that.
Great. So Susan says, when firms do employment checks, do they call each single one on your resume or the most recent one to verify title, date of employment, salary, and what happens if the firms no longer exist? So I picked this question because it's around reference checks. And for a lot of job seekers, reference checks are almost an afterthought of the process. And they, in fact, can be a very proactive piece of how you're marketing yourself. So first of all, you want to be thinking about who are going to be your references well in advance of when they're going to be called. So this issue of what if the firm doesn't exist anymore, you will have already tracked down the references. You will be able to tell your prospective employer, okay, you're going to be talking to these three people. Typically, you're providing three. You're going to be talking to these three people. This person I worked with when I was at, Manufacturers Hanover, which is a bank that hasn't existed in like 20 years, right? So you can say, I worked for Manny Hanny, but this person now works at, J.P. Morgan Chase, if I'm trying to think of all the iterations of what happened to Manufacturers Hanover. So you are going to be the one that's going to check if these firms no longer exist and give your prospective employer the ability to find the new contact information of that person. That is your responsibility. But you're also going to control the speed and also the sequence of at which they are contacting your references. So you should decide in advance, these are the three people, talk to this person first, or I would like to speak to the references, make sure that they're expecting your call, and feed them one by one in the sequence that you want them to speak to them. So you want to give the references of the people who know you very well. And coach your references. Don't assume that just because they say, yeah, I'll give you a great reference, but they might not know exactly what the job you're going for entails. And so you should tell them, this is an analytical job, it's a very research-oriented job or whatever, and I would appreciate if you would talk about that work that I did on XYZ project. Really give it to them in terms of, these are the things that I would love for you to highlight. This is the project that I told them about, that you worked with me on, so I would love if you could talk about my work on that project. Your references, if they really want to be good references, will appreciate that. It takes the work off of their shoulders, and it enables you to control as much as possible that critical piece of the search. Connie?
Okay. I'm going to answer a campus recruiting question. Jared submitted this. If we miss the recruiting deadlines, is there any way to get our foot in the door? What are other ways to go about getting a job right out of college if we miss the fall application deadlines? Okay, so when you're a student, there are two ways of finding a job. One, on-campus recruiting. Two, off-campus recruiting. That covers the universe. Of course, you should maximize on-campus recruiting because these are interested employers that come to your campus. If you've missed the deadline, all is not lost. Speak to someone in career services and see if they can help. They oftentimes have very good relationships with the representatives from companies, and they can have some pull. I mean, I ran university relations at Citigroup for many years, and I invited a lot of the career services people to my wedding because I just became very friendly with them. I was on the phone with them all the time. So perhaps all is not lost there. Okay, but say it is, let's move on to off-campus recruiting. At the same time, as doing on-campus recruiting in any way, shape, or form, and by the way, there are always last-minute openings that are put into the queue for on-campus recruiting. I did it many times in March, April, even May. So always keep your eye out for those opportunities. Okay, so now let's focus on off-campus recruiting because it is a numbers game. If you have more targets, you're going to have more opportunities. And here are four things that you need to really master to maximize your off-campus job search. Number one, network. Talk to everyone you know about who they know. This includes your parents, your relatives, your friends at the gym, people that you play soccer, tennis, golf with, your professors. A lot of them have come from industry, your teaching assistants. Who do they know, and can they make introductions for you? Number two, after that, you need to research. You need to research ahead of time to identify targets, but also as you network and you find out people have these contacts at different companies, you start to research these companies. Which ones are you most interested in? Use Google Alerts to find out more information. If you don't know what a Google Alert is, you go to Google, you type in Google Alert. It prompts you to say, what do you want to do a Google Alert on? You put the name of the company in there. Say it's J.P. Morgan Chase or Goldman Sachs. And then you put your email address, and every time that company's out in the news, you're going to get an email about that company, and you're going to become an expert on that company. So if you combine your research skills with your networking, and you know, that will hopefully lead to many warm introductions into the interview process. There are different strategies for the, you know, informational interviews. You want to ask open-ended questions that include things like, how did you get started in this business? What trends do you see happening in this industry? What advice could you give to me wanting to break into this industry? These are all questions that should allow the person to give you quite a lot of information and to either lead to a job or to lead to more networking contacts. Number three, your marketing materials have to be impeccable. Your resume, your cover letter, your online profile, your networking pitch. You have to have these things polished and ready to go. I just looked at someone's resume that he had a 20-year accounting resume, 20 years of experience. I could not believe the mistake in his resume. He had the same job information listed twice on his resume. He had AIG listed twice with the same bullets. I just couldn't believe he's been going out with that resume. I know he has. So I had an attorney who was the head of the trust department, making well over $1 million. Experience was spelt wrong on her resume. So enough said about that, but, you know, make sure they're impeccable. And number four, your follow-up skills. Ensure you know how to follow up effectively when you're conducting an off-campus job search or a job search of any kind if you're not a campus student. After every interview, the last question before you walk out the door should be, Will I expect to hear from you, or would you like me to follow up? Or, you know, how long do you think I'll hear from you about next steps? Be very clear about that, because I was always impressed when a candidate did that, because I felt that they really were in control and organized and forward-thinking. So I thought very highly of that. And be very careful of that, because with on-campus recruiting, everything is run in a very tight schedule. With off-campus recruiting, there is no schedule. So you have to make sure that you control that and move ahead in a productive way. Caroline?
Great. So we're just about in the middle of the hour, so I just wanted to make sure that everybody on the call had some ongoing information about us and about Vault. So in terms of getting in touch with Six Figure Start, your registration for this class includes our newsletter that comes out twice a month, and so that will give you more information, free career-related articles, and information about upcoming events. You can follow both us and Vault on Twitter and on LinkedIn. We have groups set up there so that like-minded job seekers can interact with each other. And starting next week, we are going to have weekly teleseminars, these Ask Six Figure Start, you know, Vault.com insider career advice teleseminars on specific topics. So next Thursday, April 1st, is Master the Interview Part 1, and that's going to be led by Connie. She's going to talk about the top 5 things you should do during an interview, the biggest mistakes and how to avoid them, the different types of interviews you can think about, you know, what you're getting into, and how you can ace any interview in terms of that first interview getting to the second round. So that's going to be next Thursday, April 1st, again at 12 p.m. Eastern. I'm going to be leading a teleseminar the following week on Friday, April 9th, also at 12 p.m. Eastern. What are the 12 most popular interview questions, and what do employers really want to know when they ask them? So when I say tell me about yourself, don't tell me about yourself, that kind of thing. Also, what are the 3 types of questions and the best approach for each of them? Because there's an endless amount of questions that you can practice for an interview, but there are categories of questions, and there are really 3 main categories. And if you can figure out what your approach is going to be for those 3 big categories, you're going to be 80% of the way there. You know that you need to give examples when you interview. What are the 5 pieces of information that you need to give to ensure that you have a comprehensive example? And then finally, interviews are stressful, and what are some of the techniques and strategies you can use to make sure that you're at your best at that start of the interview? So these teleseminars, again, April 1st, April 9th, they're going to be an hour long. They're $27 each, and that includes the live call and a downloadable recording of the call. And we reward early action because we're coaches and we want you to get out there. So if you register for both April 1st and April 9th, by this Sunday, March 28th, so 11:59 p.m. this Sunday, March 28th, you will get, in addition to the classes, you'll get your choice of 1 free month of Vault Gold membership or free pass to a future teleseminar, because we will be conducting different topics, again, on a weekly basis, Friday at 12 p.m. On an ongoing basis. So you'll be able to get a third teleseminar free if you register, again, for both teleseminars by this Sunday. Connie?
Okay. Let's go on to the next question, because it deals with career change. And I think we had at least over, you know, a dozen questions about career change in this economy. So Akhil writes, I am currently employed in internal audit for a Fortune 500 company, and I make a pretty good salary. I'm looking to get out of auditing slash accounting roles to more finance slash strategic roles, and I have been accepted to a top 20 MBA program to potentially change my skill set. My question is, should I pursue the MBA or stay with the company and try to grow internally? I have promising leads within the company, but there's no certainty of when opportunities will open up. I don't want to leave a well-paying job for an MBA if the value of an MBA has been significantly diluted over the last couple of years. So this is a big decision, and it deserves a lot of thought. Nothing is guaranteed in life, as we all know. I happen to think that if you have promising leads within a company that will get you greater and greater opportunities there and will allow you to grow and increase your skill set, that perhaps you consider riding that wave for now. Perhaps that could be instrumental in helping you obtain an executive MBA, and then you'll have the best of both worlds. Mentors are amazing people, and for anyone on the call, if you don't have a mentor, I suggest that you give it a lot of thought and select at least one or two people to mentor you, because they can give you a perspective that you normally wouldn't have. It could be a mentor in the company that you're in now if you're employed. It could be, if you're employed, it could be someone outside of the company. If you're unemployed, it could be someone that you respected quite a bit while you were at a particular company. So you don't have to be employed or unemployed. Either way, you can have an amazing mentor. But since quite a lot of this decision is riding on the opportunity that you have at the firm, having a mentor at that firm to give you additional information would be very helpful. Now, if you do decide to go for your MBA, which could be a very good decision, you can maintain that network. So just because you have promising leads within the company, those leads can continue even if you leave. I mean, some of my best networking contacts come from interviews I had at companies where I didn't take the opportunity. Just because if you have a quality interaction, you're going to stay in touch with those people no matter what. I left Merrill Lynch in June of 2007, and we all know what happened to Merrill Lynch, but now I have amazing contacts at Morgan Stanley. I have great contacts at Novartis. I have phenomenal contacts at I would say, a dozen companies, because people have been dispersed and they're working in different places. So maintain your network while obtaining your MBA. You just need to follow up well, and there are tons of ways to follow up. You can follow up with people wishing them happy holiday, wishing them, you know, thanking them for any advice that they've given you, congratulating them if they got a promotion or landed a new job. You can send them an article of interest. There's so many ways to follow up with people to keep your network going. The smartest people have a systematic way of following up with their network. And I mean that, you know, if you contact someone today, March 26th, you might in your calendar 6 weeks from now contact that person again. So today is March 26th, so maybe May 14th you might drop them an email and you know, wish them, you know, happy summer. You know, what are you doing for this summer? Do you have any plans, et cetera? So maintain your network. That's pretty vital. And you also might want to consider the expense of an MBA, especially if you don't have a job coming in. Do a pro and con analysis on what's best for you. There are so many things to consider, and it really has to be an individual choice. But, you know, can you live well without that salary coming in? What about the location? Does that impact anything? So perhaps the executive MBA is the way to go, perhaps an MBA at night. There are so many different things to do, but I would put it all out on a piece of paper. Carolyn?
Great. So I'm going to jump to Lisa's question, but first I'm getting a number of inquiries on the online Q&A. How do I sign up for the April 1 and 9 seminars? So, Connie, you should fire me as a pitch woman. So I am going to be sending to all of the registrants a thank you email for being on this call, and that will include the links to the teleseminars, and also they will be on vault.com. So you'll be able to see information about the teleseminars on vault.com, and then, of course, in the thank you email that you'll be getting later on today. So Lisa asks, would paid temp work look better than taking on a volunteer stint? She has already done some volunteer work. She has gotten another opportunity to volunteer in something that's heavy on exposure to a sector that she is interested in working. So there are a couple of questions here. One is that decision between paid and volunteer. Obviously, there's the career aspect of it, and it sounds like the way she's talking about it, that the volunteer work is more important in terms of more targeted towards what she wants to do. And in that case, it's a no-brainer. You would take the volunteer work. But there's another issue here, which is obviously the financial issue. And if you can afford to do that, if you might need to do some temp work that might not be related to what your target search is, but perhaps will give you the buoyancy, will give you less of the anxiety so that you can really focus on your search in a more targeted, more relaxed way. So there are pros and cons to doing both the paid and the volunteer. The other thing you want to think about with volunteer work is that you don't have to, on your resume, say this is volunteer work. So, you know, I often see job seekers, you know, really break it out and advertise, okay, this is my real work experience and this is my volunteer experience. And it really should be about the substance of what the work is. So if you have done a marketing campaign or have done, you know, treasury, you know, the finances for a nonprofit and it's really substantive work, you know, absolutely put that in your work experience and focus less on the pay and the process and more on what is the substance of the experience. And again, determining whether or not you do the volunteer work should take into account whether or not you can afford to do it, whether that will keep you in your search long enough to get both the substantive work and the pay for it. Connie?
Okay. Freya asked this question. What is the best way to make yourself seem qualified for a job in a totally new field when you have the skills but not the related experience? I'm looking for a career change, but recruiters tend to comment on my lack of experience. Well, my answer to that is, remember in the previous earlier in the call when I mentioned making a list of your top 10 skills. That exercise will be helpful here. Figure out what the top skills are for this new field and prove that you can succeed there in your cover letter and certainly quantify it in your resume. You'll also need to create a pitch, a 20 or 30 second pitch that bridges the gap of what you did versus what you want to do. I suggest typing it out until it's in your tone, it's in the words that you use, and then I would practice it 10, 20, 30 times until it rolls off the tip of your tongue. I'd make sure that there's passion and enthusiasm in your voice because I've always gravitated towards hiring people that that demonstrate passion and have enthusiasm and really want the job. I can have four people with the same skills, but I'll go to the enthusiastic person every single time. And you don't have to jump up and down. I have to see it in your eyes. I have to see that strong eye contact, smile during an interview when you're excited about, you know, describing your favorite project. I've had some people describe their favorite project, and it looked like they were totally bored. And that just makes me move away from that candidate. So in addition to that, don't forget to do extra research here. You have to know everything about that field, so do your Google alert, become a complete expert, and network with everyone you can in this field. Become a people sponge. Talk to as many people as you can, focusing on this field as possible. You have a mission, and that's your job when you're looking for a job. You know, you're not unemployed. You have a job. You're just not getting paid for it. You have to execute a very well-defined and you know, job search. In a quick second question, Freya says, are there any buzzwords that stand out to recruiters in resumes? The short answer is no. You have to have a very well-written resume that quantifies the value that you bring to your past, that you've brought to your past employers, because it proves that you will bring them in the future. For example, a bullet point could be, and it recently was on a resume I reviewed, created spreadsheets of sales metrics. Okay, well, that's Newsville. That'll put me to sleep. But what it should have said was created Excel spreadsheets of all sales metrics, including sales per region, exact quantities sold, profit margins, etc. Highlighted trends and shared with senior management, who then adjusted sales strategies nationwide. So this is a difference in a bullet that makes all the difference. You know, so you can't just have a well-written resume that has no mistakes. You have to make sure it's compelling. You have to make sure that things are quantified. And as far as buzzwords, I'm going to give you a little secret on a resume, that sometimes companies, larger companies, have parsing systems. They'll electronically go through your resume, parse those resumes that have the buzzwords that they're looking for, and then, you know, say at Merrill Lynch, I could put in my top 7 filters that I was looking for a position if 500 people applied to them, and then they'd give me the top 5% of all of those resumes that met those characteristics, those filters that I was most interested in. If you don't have the experience and you're interested in the position, go to the bottom of your resume and type the buzzwords in, like investment banking, corporate finance, private equity, valuation modeling. Put them on the very bottom of your resume and then turn the type white. Okay? It's invisible to the naked eye, but it's not invisible to those parsing systems. And maybe that will give you an additional visibility that might land you the job. So there's my little cheater tip for today. Caroline?
Okay, so Linda asked, I'm an undergrad coming from a top business school that's intensely competitive. Oftentimes, it's difficult to figure out what employers are looking for when everyone's intelligent and capable. More often than not, I'm told that it just comes down to fit. But what does that mean? Ah, yes, fit. It was like our favorite word, right, Connie, as recruiters. Well, there just wasn't a fit to this job. The reason why recruiters love the word fit is because it's nebulous. I mean, it's vague. It's purposely vague. That's the point. We don't want any kind of legal liability issues for telling you exactly, you know, what you did wrong in the interview or why we don't like you. You don't also want to get into a back and forth with the candidate. And sometimes it's not because the candidate did anything wrong, because he didn't like the candidate. It was because really, you know, there was, again, someone internal raised their hand, or there was someone who was better, more experienced in whatever it is. So fit is that buzzword that encompasses everything. You're not going to get feedback from a recruiter because the liability issues loom large. You will get feedback from your network and from mentors and from those informational interviews that you should be able to do with alumni, perhaps, from your alma mater, again, from people within your network who are willing to talk to you. And what you're trying to find out is, if you were in a position, you know, to hire me, so if you had a job, you know, in corporate communications, if that was what you were looking for, you know, would you hire someone like myself for that job? And if not, why not? So that you can get, you know, that realistic feedback in terms of what are the things that you're missing. Is it a skill set? Is it the way that you're speaking and the persona that you're coming across? Is it that you don't have specific experience in writing a press release or running a campaign, and that's something that you can get perhaps your last semester of school by volunteering or by consulting or something else? But, again, a recruiter is not going to give you that information. You're going to have to try to get that information from your own network. And this is why we really encourage the informational interview, because it's not just about, you know, trying to find those leads into jobs. It's about trying to get that candid feedback that you don't want to get and that you won't get during a real-life job situation. Connie?
Okay. I'm going to tackle a question on salary negotiation. Lisa wrote in, what's the best way to approach a recruiter about salary negotiation? I'm about to graduate college and already have signed with a consulting firm. Congratulations. But she still wants to know, A, how someone new to the workforce should approach negotiation, and B, how that changes when you have a few years of experience. So Caroline and I are getting buttons that say negotiate everything, because everything is negotiable. And the worst that can happen is that they say no, because in my 25 years of experience in Fortune 500 company recruiting, I have never seen an offer pulled because you asked for something a little bit more than what was offered. So if you're just graduating, there really may be no room for negotiation. You start off with an entry-level salary. If you're hired into these big firms like, you know, Goldman Sachs, JPMorgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, they have a defined salary that you come in at, and we won't negotiate that. You have defined benefits package. But if it's a smaller company, yes, there's room for that. So what we say is if it's not one of those big programs, then you can make a list of what the offer is in terms of cash offerings and non-cash. So cash offerings, just your base salary, maybe some commission, non-cash, your vacation, your personal days, your 401k, all your benefits. I recently coached a client who wanted an uptick in the salary, but she didn't get it. But we had prepared what she was going to say as far as what she wanted next. And her next request was, okay, if you can't go up with the salary, can I get an extra week's vacation? And she got it. I had a college student who wasn't hired into a big program. He was hired really, he was a chemical engineer, hired by the military, and he asked, you know, he was offered $53,000. And he said, you know, Connie, I have a 3.9 chemical engineering degree. I think I should be making $65,000. And I said, well, what makes you think that? And he said, well, I don't know. I thought $65,000 was a good number. I said, look, do your research. What does this job pay? What will the market bear? Go to your career services and ask them about it. Go to vault.com. They have salary information. Payscale.com. Go to Google and Google the salary info. Network and ask what people think, you know, what people are being paid in this field. He did go back to his manager, and he realized 60 was a much better range, and he asked for 60. The hiring manager said, I can't. My hands are tied. The position pays 53. That's all I have in my budget. But in 6 months, I can review you and increase your salary by 13,000. In addition, you can get your PhD on this base while you're working. So that was something that he was really excited about. So you can negotiate into something that will make you happy. The employer, with all the trouble we go through to find the right candidate, we do want you to be happy. So we will try to give wherever we can. So make a list of what's important to you and practice it, because for some reason conversations about salary gets caught in the middle of someone's throat every time. Salary was never really the main reason why I took any job, but it was pretty much in the top three reasons of why I took a job. So practice what you're going to say. So much of it is in the practicing, the interviewing, the practicing, the networking pitch, all of that. You have to work on that. Caroline?
Great. Lynn says, are thank you notes post-interview still expected? What's current protocol on thank you notes for phone screenings and or phone interviews? Has a lack of a thank you note ever been a deal breaker for a candidate? So it's interesting that despite how much has been written about thank you notes, that we're still debating on whether or not they're even necessary. Yes, they are necessary. Yes, they are necessary. Yes, they are necessary. Has a lack of a thank you note ever been a deal breaker? Yes, it has. I had a client that was livid about not getting one, and it was interesting. It was a sales related job, and the feeling was, it's like, what is the judgment of this person that they, you know, isn't this interview one on one? That they are going to send me a thank you note. And what was unfortunate, this was the same client, a separate situation, was at one point the client was upset about not getting a thank you note. They actually got it a week later because the mail was so slow within that company. So the most conservative approach is to email your thank you note within 24 to 48 hours. 48 hours is really the outward bound within 24 hours because its email is ideal, and then to follow up with a written thank you note if you want to write something that's more substantial. Phone screenings and phone interviews, of course, it's the same thing. What you're thanking the person for is for their time. It's also another reason to get in front of this person. And so whether or not you're a live interview or it's a phone interview, the time factor is still there. Certainly in front of mind factor is still there. So you absolutely want to do it for phone interviews. You want to do it for informational interviews. It is a nice, polite gesture. And finally, thank you notes are not meant to be throwaway. Thank you so much for the interview. Thank you for taking the time. I'd really like the job. Those are, you know, that is thank you note 101. And absolutely, if that's all you can muster, that's what you should do. But an advanced form of job search is to use that thank you note to really personalize it to the person that you're talking to add on the discussion that you had during the interview. You've had some time to reflect about what was missing and what you were answering in the interview. You know more about the company because you've just spoken to them. So you can take the discussion to the next level. in the thank you note. So the thank you note is not just a nice, polite gesture, which it is and is absolutely required, but it can also be another entry point in your search, another example of your problem solving, your consultative approach to the job, and your willingness to go that extra mile to do the work that is required. Connie?
Okay, we have 5 minutes left to this teleclass, so we have time for one more question. I'm going to answer it from someone that just sent it through the Q&A, and it's Kelly from Boston, who asked, when applying for a job by email, is it best to include the cover letter in the body of the email or to include both the cover letter and the resume as an attachment? Either way works, Kelly. I kind of like that the cover letter be in the email, but be exactly the email. But what I would suggest you do is keep it as short as possible. If you're going to put it in the email, I'm looking for 3 paragraphs at the most. If it's going to be a cover letter as an attachment, you probably want 4 or 5 paragraphs. But you want to keep it really short. You know, a cover letter has three main components. In the first paragraph, you're going to list that you're applying for a particular job and what you're currently doing, and then you're going to say, attached is my resume. In the last paragraph, you're going to reiterate your interest. You're going to state that your skills are perfect to the position that you're applying to, and you're going to let them know that you'll call them in a week to follow up. It's the magic's in the middle. The magic's in the middle. It's where you make the case for why you would be a perfect employee for this job, why your skills are unique, and why you can bring the company to where they need to go. So that's a very, very important thing to do. Okay. Caroline, do you have a short question and answer that you can put in? Or?
You know, there were a couple of questions that I had highlighted that people had asked. You know, I want to post my resume. Are there websites that recruiters go to? How much say does a recruiter have in deciding who's going to be interviewed? Is it worth it to apply to jobs on the web, or are they long gone before you even apply for them? There were a lot of questions around the secret behind working with recruiters or job postings. And I did want to point out that 80% of jobs that are filled outside of job postings and outside of recruiters. They're filled via employee referrals, by networking, by direct contact, so that that person who had asked about, you know, is it worth it to send unsolicited resumes, it absolutely is, because there's that, you know, 80%. So when you think about your job search and how you're going to be spending your time, absolutely, people do get jobs from the job boards. I used the job boards when I was a recruiter, especially when I was looking for something very, very specific, when I did an After Effects animator search for Disney. That's something that's very searchable, and so I looked at specific technical job boards, you know, to look for those candidates. But those things aside, again, I was working my network. I was working candidates already in my pipeline. I didn't, when I was in-house, didn't always run to an external search agency. And when I was an executive recruiter on the outside, you know, my clients were looking for something very, very specific. So I wasn't very, you know, a generalist recruiter. So if you're focusing on postings and recruiters and you're really, really fretting about that, that's 20% of your search. That should be one day out of your week. The rest of the time really should be focused on identifying those companies that you want, identifying the people within the companies that you should be approaching, and really making your approach and focusing on networking. That is where you will get the most bang for your buck. Connie?
Okay, before I close the call, I am going to sneak in one more response. Camilla from Toronto wrote, at the beginning of this workshop, you were talking about one of your clients who was making a big mistake in the final interview and was disqualifying herself. Would you be able to tell us about this mistake? Since I can do it very quickly, I will. I asked her, how does she deal with a difficult manager? She was someone who had, she was an HR professional for 20 years. And she said, well, I usually give them what they want the first time, and then when they have trust in me, I can implement what's really, you know, what I know to be the best. And that was a huge mistake, of course, because, you know, as an HR professional, you're a consultant to the business, and you have to prove your worth as a consultant, and you have to hold your ground and say, look, if you want to do this, that's your choice, but you're going to get X results. If you do it this way, and I've seen it proven to be a very successful way to go, you'll get this result. And then if he decides or she decides to go down the path that she wants, you know, at least you can be vindicated that, you know, you expressed knowledge about what will happen if she goes down this path. She also listed as her weakness one of the main requirements for the job, which was she wanted to get a little bit better at e-learning. And, you know, when I was at Merrill Lynch in the last 7 years there, almost all my training was e-learning. So, you know, you can't do something like that. All right, so it is exactly 1 o'clock. We want to close out this call. We thank the hundreds and hundreds of people, over 1,000 people registered, the hundreds of you that took place, and a lot of people are going to be downloading this, and the amazing questions that we've gotten. We wish we could have answered more. In closing, I want to remind you that you can download this. Just go to the same link, and you can listen to it again. We will give two teleseminars on interviewing skills. Interviewing really is it's where the rubber meets the road in the job search. If you don't interview well, things aren't going to go well. So for $27 a piece, we have on April 1st interview skills level 1, and on April 9th interview skills level 2, where the interview questions are decoded. And our entire curriculum will be posted for you to review, and it will include teleseminars on how to network, how networking can lead to your next job, how to negotiate well, resume writing skills, you know, really getting into the details of resume writing skills. So we thank you all. This is Connie Thanasula Saraccio signing off, Caroline Sinise Levine. We've loved having you. Six Figure Start has partnered with Vault to create these teleseminars, and we hope to hear from you soon. We hope that you'll sign up for more to come. Thanks so much for your time.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
The moderator has